What Bitcoin Did podcast.
Hi there, how are you all? Welcome to the What Bitcoin Did podcast, brought to you by Kraken, the best place to buy, sell, and trade digital currencies. I'm your host, Peter McCormack, and today I have the fifth interview in my Mt. Gox series, an interview with Brock Pierce. But before that, I have a message from my show sponsors. And listen, I've got three ads today. Having sold the ads to do this Mt. Gox series, I've got an outstanding other ad. So I've got three today. Don't jump them, just give them a chance. So firstly, let's talk about BlockFi. If you're interested in a crypto-backed loan, well, BlockFi is the leading crypto-to-USD lender servicing customers worldwide, including 47 US states, and their interest rates start as low as 4.5%. Also, BlockFi accepts Bitcoin, Ether, or Litecoin as collateral. Customers can be funded in USD or GUSD, which is Gemini's dollar-backed stablecoin, and you can go from application to funding in as little as 30 minutes. If you sign up at blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid, you can get $25 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans for under $10,000 or $50 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans over $10,000, and applying takes less than 2 minutes. That is blockfi.com/whatbitcoindid. And let's talk about the mighty Cash App again. Thank you so much to these guys for helping me do this series for Mt. Gox this week. I really do appreciate them coming through on this. They helped me get out to Japan, so that was super cool of them. So what is the Cash App? Have you got it? Have you got it on your phone? Have you checked it out? I downloaded it. I think it's pretty damn cool, actually. They don't have Bitcoin trading yet in the UK. It's only in the US, but I'm really looking forward to it coming. It's probably something that's going to be a really good recommendation for like friends and families who want to get into Bitcoin who aren't really there yet. So I'm looking forward to that. You Americans, you've already got it. Let me know what it's like. Let me know what you think of it. So what about Cash App? It is the first traditional peer-to-peer payments app to support Bitcoin. It comes with most of the features of a traditional bank account. You've got the ability to direct deposit your paycheck into the app, and you get a physical, customizable debit card, which is linked for you to spend from. You get the ability to earn 10% back at places like Whole Foods with your Cash Boost, and this can be used in tandem with your Bitcoin balance. There isn't an app like it out there. It's pretty damn cool. So make sure you check it out. Head over to Apple or Google Play Store, and you can download it by searching for the Cash App, which is CASH APP. And as I said, look, the Bitcoin part is only available in the US. And finally, let's talk about Paxful. And this is their final ad with me. Sad to see them go, but very grateful. I want to say a big thank you to them for sponsoring the podcast for the last couple of months. Did you ever check them out? If you didn't, just do it now. They've been a great supporter of the podcast. Head over to paxful.com and find out why they are a proper Bitcoin company, offering the most comprehensive options for buying Bitcoin available. They accept bank transfers, debit and credit cards, PayPal, and Western Union. They've got over 300 different payment options for buying Bitcoin, which is insane. It's all on their website. Head over there and check it out. And also remember, they're a true peer-to-peer Bitcoin marketplace. They offer a full-service escrow system, and they have 24/7 customer support. They're totally awesome. I'm really grateful to them for sponsoring the podcast for the last few months. So head over to paxful.com, which is paxful.com. Okay, so on to my interview with Brock. Where do I start with this? Okay, I'm really looking forward to the feedback on this interview. I don't think it's a great interview, but I can't tell if it's down to me not being a great interviewer, not controlling the conversation in the right way, or because of the way Brock handled it. I feel like he was trying to, trap me, or there's like this change in narrative with him, and it was kind of tying me up in knots. So it's not the greatest interview, or I don't know, maybe you think it is. Maybe you'll listen and go, that was brilliant. I don't know. The thing is, Brock is tied to the Mt. Gox story. So as I was preparing this set of interviews, I knew he had to be part of it. I knew it was important to get him involved. But I'll save my judgment for the outro. You can listen to that after the interview. Listen to what I think about it. But if you do have any questions about it and you want to contact me, my email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. And listen, if you want to support the show, if you've enjoyed these Mt. Gox interviews and you want to support what I'm doing, there's a section on my website. Head over to whatbitcoindid.com and click on the support button. That'll tell you all the things you can do. And I need to thank my Patreon top tier sponsor, Vidyen, who create open source plugins which you can use to reward users with virtual items or store credit when they mine crypto in their browser on your WordPress site. That is vidyen.com, which is vidyen.com. Okay, so onto the interview. Like I said, if you've got any questions, feel free to reach out to me. My email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com. Hi there, Brock. How are you doing?
No, I'm doing well. Been a good and very busy couple of weeks.
Yeah, I can imagine. And thank you for rescheduling. We were meant to talk tomorrow, but I'm taking a very late flight to Tokyo to talk to Mark Karpeles. So it's obviously good to talk to you as well. I'm trying to build up the entire picture of the story and talk to everyone. So good to talk to you. It'll be good to talk to him. Just before we get going, just one off-topic question. How's everything in Puerto Rico?
Oh, yeah, Puerto Rico. Well, we've been down there for about a year and a half. Obviously, things were very, very bad following Hurricane Maria. And it took a very long time for, you know, just kind of call it the basic infrastructure to be back up and running. But the island is, for the most part, you know, entirely recovered from the hurricane, with the exceptions of the center of the island, the very remote sort of places where, you know, when power lines go down that are going into very small villages, those sorts of groups are still, you know, suffering to some extent. But then all the cities are, you know, fully recovered. The real issue, though, is not, you know, the hurricane. The real issue is, you know, what I refer to as a sustained brain drain. It's, you know, due to a lack of opportunity, the best and the brightest, the people with the, you know, intellectual capital, the human capital, the financial capital, the spiritual capital, those people, due to a lack of opportunity, are consistently leaving. You know, following Hurricane Maria, Puerto Rico went from 3.5 million people to to 3 million people, losing 500,000 people. Who do you think were the 500,000 to leave? It's the people with the means to do so. You know, it's the people that have, you know, the abundance of, you know, the things that I mentioned. And so Puerto Rico has been, you know, undergoing a sustained brain drain. And I don't just mean of the current leaders, but I mean the future leaders. You know, Puerto Ricans are so well-educated. They're so capable. They're so competent. But due to a lack of opportunity, you know, when you graduate from college, you leave. You know, Puerto Rico's number one export is human beings, Puerto Ricans. They have the number 15 engineering school in the United States. Facebook, Google, NASA, Exxon have basically full-time recruiters hanging out at the universities because it's one of the best schools in the country, but where there's no jobs. I mean, it's one of the best places to hire people. And so Puerto Rico is undergoing this sustained brain drain. And how do you combat a brain drain? With a brain gain. And so what we're trying to do is bring in some of that intellectual capital, some of that human capital, some of that financial capital, some of that spiritual capital to bring and, you know, bring angels, you know, angel investors, bring mentors, bring some of that positivity and hopefully provide tools to enable new opportunities. Historically, there had been no Puerto Rican startups that had ever raised money. Two startups the end of last year raised over $1 million each. We're going to have hopefully many more of those this year. Because you now have angels, you know, because you now have mentors, because you have co-working facilities, you have accelerators, you have incubators, you have co-living spaces, you know, you have the beginning of a startup society emerging, which means if you have a dream to do something entrepreneurial, you don't have to go to New York or San Francisco anymore. You now can stay in Puerto Rico. Or if you're a Puerto Rican that is left and working on a startup in San Francisco or New York, it's now an option to go back to Puerto Rico and work on these things. Historically, that has not been the case. And one of the things that we as a community can do more than anything else, one of the areas where we can have a big impact is obviously in this area. You know, we're a startup culture. And so, governments spend hundreds of billions of dollars trying to make the types of impact we're talking about or, you know, hoping or aspiring to make and often fail. So, this is, again, one of those really big, kind of crazy, audacious kind of goals. And, you know, if we're really lucky, we can bring some of these tools that starts to inspire some change, you know, for things to really turn around. You know, maybe 5,000 or 10,000 of us can move down there over time. But hopefully, you know, what we're really counting on is that 250,000 really talented Puerto Ricans go back to Puerto Rico out of, call it, the 6 million of the diaspora. You know, Puerto Rico's long-term success is going to be determined by a bunch of really talented Puerto Ricans going back to Puerto Rico and to be responsible for, you know, making things better. There's, you know, we're a tiny little community that are just there to do what we can. But, you know, Puerto Rico's long-term success is going to be determined by Puerto Ricans. We're just here to be to support in the little ways we can.
Right. Because I know it's important to you and I know the population suffered after Maria, but we got a lot to unpack here. I've spoken to Jed, I've spoken to Daniel Kelman, I'm going to be speaking to Mark, I'm speaking to you, I've spoken to a lot of people, so there's a lot to unpack here. I'm trying to build a picture of the whole story of what's going on with Mt. Gox, so I'm going to work through it with you. Just to begin with, Brock, tell me where you fit in to the whole picture and the whole story of Mt. Gox, and also, Did you actually, are you an actual creditor as well? Did you lose in Mt. Gox in the original hack?
So I've been involved in, you know, in some way with Mt. Gox for, call it 6-7 years. It all started with me, you know, looking at acquiring the business and call it late 2012 and early 2013. And that's where I got, call it, engaged with Mark and engaged with the business for the first time. In terms of being a creditor, no, because after the first attempt of buying the business, which, you know, went on my organization for, call it, 6 to 9 months, when I went back the second time to acquire the business, and then it evolved into, you know, working on a joint venture to create MtGox.cn and to bring Mt. Gox into China. This is before Bitcoin was popular in China. And my background was in virtual currency in China. You know, we had a supply chain of about 400,000 people playing games to mine currencies in China. We helped launch Alipay and lots of things. So I figured, yeah, we can introduce China to Bitcoin in a big way, and Mt. Gox would have been the right platform to do it with. But, you know, one of the problems is Mark Karpeles was running a bakery at the time. And I think he was spending 6 to 8 hours a day, you know, focused on making Danish and croissants. And this is as Mt. Gox was at its, you know, at its highest points. This is as Bitcoin was running up. So instead of securing, you know, those customer funds and making sure that, you know, the business was being well run, he was more interested in his baking skills. And so after having seen that, I didn't see anything that said money was missing. I didn't see anything that led me to believe that a fraud, you know, was occurring. But I certainly saw a lot of, call it, incompetence and a lot of mismanagement. And, you know, a CEO who's supposed to be running a high growth business and a fiduciary of hundreds of millions of dollars of customer money, more interested in his croissants and Danish than his customers and his business, which was not a, it didn't inspire any confidence in the exchange. but I didn't see any criminal acts in my diligence, but I wasn't also given, you know, Mark wasn't very forthcoming. He wasn't giving me full access to the books. I wasn't, you know, he was very protective of the innermost details. Obviously I would have rang the alarm bells had I known something, you know, if I had known, you know, that he was, that Mt. Gox had already been hacked and that he was aware of it and that he wasn't telling anyone and that he was running a Willy bot or things of that nature. Had I known the things that we know now, I would have done more, but it's not my business when I haven't seen any, you know, I'm seeing, call it, mismanagement. But that doesn't give me the right to go and, you know, to the biggest business in the space and tell everyone, hey, you know, you need to pull your money out now. I don't think, I was never given enough information where I felt that needed to happen. But personally, I wasn't going to use Mt. Gox considering, you know, all that I'd seen.
Okay. And then do you own Mt. Gox or do you have a claim to Mt. Gox?
Yeah, I've never said I own Mt. Gox. And if you look at any of the interviews or any of my statements, you know, I said, you know, I have a claim or I arguably or I might. I signed deals with both Jed McCaleb and Mark Karpeles to acquire the business in early 2014. And again, this was when the business was worth negative hundreds of millions of dollars. This was not like, you know, the only reason there was zero opportunity there. The only reason that I got involved then and the only reason I'm still involved now is I care about what's best for Bitcoin. You know, I've got more investments than almost anyone in this space, maybe anyone. I've started, I think, more companies than anyone in this space. So what's good for Bitcoin is good for me. You know, this is why when you watch my talks or you watch my interviews, most people are busy promoting their project and speaking biasly about their project. And I almost never promote anything. I basically just talk about the ecosystem because what's good for the ecosystem generally is good for me.
Right. Okay. That sounds a bit like Roger. Roger does that. He talks about.
Yeah. No. Roger is, again, anyone that where your eggs are not all in one basket, but you're, you know, like you're so cross-pollinated all over the ecosystem. I don't care if this project succeeds or that project succeeds. I don't care if it's a project that I own part of or own none of. to me, I'm indifferent as long as I care about the well-being of the entire ecosystem.
Right. Okay.
And so the reason for getting involved in this deal when it first collapsed is I was very concerned about the impact a failure of Mt. Gox was going to have on the ecosystem. You know, my view on day one, and this is before it became evident, is that this was going to be our Lehman Brothers. You know, this was going to be our Bear Stearns. And I said very specifically to Mark at the time, and I think to more or less everyone I spoke to, that this is probably going to set our industry back by a year or two. This is going to trigger a very deep bear market, you know, for the ecosystem. And I think I was right. You know, Mt. Gox's failure in 2014 was responsible more than anything else for the bear market of 2014 and 15. And you could even argue it's somewhat responsible for the bear market of today.
Yeah, I agree. Almost certainly the first bear market you referred to. But also, there are some benefits to what happened with Mt. Gox in that it became a big warning to all future exchanges on how important security could be. So I'm not going to excuse anyone's previous mistakes, but I guess when you're creating the first ever global Bitcoin exchange, there's a lot of challenges that you are unaware of because they haven't happened. Whereas if you're creating after Mt. Gox, at least you've got some experience of some of the things that have happened. And also, I do sometimes think we look at 2013 with our 2018 $20,000 Bitcoin eyes on, and perhaps don't always appreciate it was a different time. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I do, but I would disagree with you a little bit on one point. I believe you're right in the sense of what should have happened. Mt. Gox should have been a warning of what not to do. And it should have caused the industry to raise the bar, you know, and it should have woken Bitcoin holders up not to leave their money in centralized exchanges, to withdraw more frequently, all the things we would have, could have, should have done and learned from that experience. But it's not an isolated incident. What happened at Mt. Gox has continued to happen over 2014, 15, 16, 17, 18, and it's already happened. We're barely, you know, just over a month into this year, and we've already had Cryptopia and Quadriga. The fact that these types of events continue to plague our industry like a broken record is shocking. I mean, I'm going to make a pretty outlandish statement with my next words, but we talk about how we're the future of the financial system. We sometimes like to think that we might be better than the old financial system. The reality is, if someone came to me and said, hey, should I put my money into this or banks? I'd say, no, you should keep your money in banks. Banks are better than we are today. That isn't how it should be. But that still is a reality because the exchanges have not raised the bar. The exchanges are not doing all they can do. We have not evolved into non-custodial exchanges. Exchanges are not systematically using multi-sig in the way that they should. Customers are not, you know, pulling out their money as often as they should. They're not being their own banks. The reality is the problems that existed in 2013 still exist to a degree far greater than they should right now.
We shouldn't group everyone together though, right? Because, you know, some exchanges operate with great practices. I mean, I think what Jesse Powell's doing at Kraken is pretty impressive. I'm not a huge fan of Coinbase or Gemini, but as far as I'm aware, they're pretty good with their custody. I think it's, you know, case by case basis. There are better examples and there's still poor examples. But anyway, let's get back to the key points. So let's separate your deal with Jed's 12% and Mark separately. I'm just going to go based on what I've read. So from Jed's understanding, it was for one Bitcoin and he never received it. What's the status of that 12%?
Jed and I have been talking and we continue to talk. Jed has stated to me recently, as well as I think to the Fortune journalist, I don't know what he said to you, but he said that, you know, he continues to support this claim. I don't know what he said to you. More importantly, you know, I'll have a lot more to say about that in the days to come, because there's a lot of documentation related to this stuff that A, hasn't been published, but most importantly, I don't even care who owns it. This is the part of the conversation I'm a little confused by. I've made it very clear that I think creditors deserve 100% of that cash and coin. It's my goal to make that equity worthless. I think I've been pretty consistent in those statements. I think the equity should get nothing. The equity should be wiped out. The victims, the 24,000 people that have filed claims with the bankruptcy court, should get everything. So it doesn't matter who owns the equity. It literally does not matter as long as the equity gets nothing. So I don't personally care. The fact that we even have conversations about this is kind of irrelevant unless someone thinks the equity deserves something. And so what I find very confusing is why people care so much. What it leads me to believe is that someone secretly is hoping to get a windfall from this. It clearly ain't me.
Why are you in disagreement with Mark over the validity of the claim then, if the equity doesn't matter?
This is Mark. This is Daniel Kelman. This isn't me. This is, Mark Karpeles, I think, believes he still runs Mt. Gox. I think he thinks he's the man kind of behind the curtain, still pulling all the strings, because Mark and Kim Nielsen are partners. They work together, is my understanding, full time. And Daniel Kelman is their lawyer, as I understand it. And so the three of them are all partners, as I understand it. And so I don't know why they care so much about this. I don't personally care much. And the only reason I'm responding to it is because they keep trying to make the claim that Mark Karpeles owns Mt. Gox. Why Mark Karpeles cares so much about owning Mt. Gox? You know, I guess I understand why. If Mark does own it, let's say I did have a claim, for example, and let's say that it was, in fact, Mark still owns the 88%, which very well could be the case, right? Let's just assume that's the case. Mark has no say in what happens at Tibane. Tibane is in bankruptcy, meaning that Tibane has a bankruptcy trustee that's currently responsible for Tibane. What is the responsibility of a bankruptcy trustee? To collect as much as that trustee can on behalf of the organization he's representing. So the bankruptcy trustee of Tibane's job is to try and get that $700 million surplus into Tibane. That's his job as I understand it, right? And so it's very easy for Mark to say, oh, I don't want any of that. But Mark doesn't even have a say in what happens. Mark has no say, or is not supposed to have any say, in what happens at Tibane. There is a bankruptcy trustee that is responsible for what happens there. And so I'm of the opinion that Mark is secretly pretending to be a saint, even though I think, considering the fact that, you know, he's being sentenced in March for fraud and other things, I think it's a hard claim to make. But it's very easy to say, I don't want anything, when he doesn't even have a say in what happens. You know, there's a bankruptcy trustee whose job it is to try and collect. So I assume that, you know, maybe Daniel Kelman has some percentage of that, and Kim, you know, I mean, they're all partners. So I'm curious why they care. I don't personally care. In an ideal world, both Mark and I would sign some sort of binding agreement that says creditors get everything. And the hell with this whole conversation. The only thing that matters is the outcome. You know, I don't care about what happened in the past. The only reason I've even mentioned it is because it's a matter of continuity. I've been working on this for 6 or 7 years. It's not relevant as far as I'm concerned. The only thing that matters is that the outcome is that the creditors get everything.
Yeah, I'm not sure on your point about Kelman. I know Kelman's a lawyer, but I don't believe has a shareholding or is a partner. I believe his interest is representing the creditors.
Well, I mean, I know he's retained by people. Who does he work for?
I can't give you the answer to that, but being retained as a lawyer...
Well, what I would love to know is Mark Karpeles a client?
Yeah, but that would be very different from claiming as a client or claiming as a partner, because a partner implies there's a business.
Well, hold on. Mark Karpeles doesn't have any money. So I imagine any lawyer that would work for Mark Karpeles would be working on a contingency basis. That is pretty much standard in law. When you don't have money and you might be someone that could be the beneficiary of a big payday, normally the way that you get representation is on a contingency basis. That's kind of the normal thing. So let's forget about this scenario. What would be standard anywhere else in the world is that the lawyers that work for Mark Karpeles would be working on a contingency basis. That would be what is normal.
Okay, but let's not go with conjecture, because neither of us know. Okay.
Nor do I know. And this is, if you're interviewing everybody, I would be asking those questions. These are the things that I don't care about who owns Mt. Gox. Somebody else clearly cares a great deal. So I'm curious why. If everybody wants the creditors to get everything, why is this conversation so important? It's kind of not relevant.
You've said, in an ideal world, that you and Mark would sign an agreement that the creditors get everything. What kind of agreement would you be signing? What's the legal basis? What is your picture here you're trying to give?
Well, my lawyers say we have a very strong claim. Now, I'll be releasing all the documentations, the documentation at some point in the not too distant future. The ideally what we would be doing is waiving a claim. The problem is, I think any document Mark would sign can't be binding, because Mark has no say in what happens at Tobain. The bankruptcy trustee of Tobain is in control of what happens at Tobain. I don't think Mark has a say in what happens.
Well, therefore, why do your lawyers think you have a good claim? Because your original contract of intent was with Mark, and he had...
So again, you have to you should reread that letter. It was not a letter of intent. It's very specifically, and I'll just give you a little bit of way of background because you may want to read it. When I called up Mark Karpeles to do that deal, and keep in mind, there's a bunch of other documents. When we agreed to that, I said, Mark, you know, Mt. Gox is in flames, mm-hmm. right? This is a crisis. You know, it's like the city is burning down, and it's the most important business in crypto at the time. You have to go back in time. And Mark has no idea what he's doing. He is so in over his head. You know, he's got his baking outfit on. You know, he's wearing his, you know, French pastry hat. And he's going, oh my God, where's, you know, and no one even knows. And all the money's missing at the time. Remember, there were no Bitcoins left. Everything was gone. Mm-hmm. Remember, that's what most people forget this. The 200,000 Bitcoin were found later. Everything was gone. And the crazy thing is those coins were being stolen over years. It didn't happen in one action, meaning that Mark Karpeles never bothered once to check the cold storage to see that the money was even there. Literally, no one was even going and checking to see, are the coins we have there? No one, you know, like, I mean, kind of crazy that you wouldn't. I mean, I understand maybe you're not checking every minute. Maybe you don't have a live feed, but you'd think every month, you know, someone would go take a look at the vault and see, you know, is, you know, do some reconciliation. I mean, kind of best practices. I mean, we're talking criminal incompetence, criminal negligence. I mean,
of course, but like, we know all this, right? These aren't new facts, right?
Yeah, so I was getting to the point of what was happening, because I don't think you've read that agreement correctly.
Okay. Well, you tell me what I've missed.
The business was in flames, and Mark agreed that I was taking over the business in full. He was stepping aside and was just going to be there to be helpful as needed. How long does it take to draft a long form agreement?
You tell me.
More than a couple of days. And we took over the business immediately. And so that binding agreement was drafted as the binding agreement so that I could start spending hundreds of thousands of dollars that day. As we were then was supposed to be drafting a long form agreement over the subsequent 60 days and let the lawyers work that out. But Mark was handing me the keys immediately. And I was paying $100,000 plus retainers in Japan, $100,000 plus dollar retainers in the US, $250,000 deals with crisis PR firms, you know, massive amounts of capital outlays, not like in the weeks to come. Immediately.
But that's your choice. If you don't have the full contract, that's still your choice.
No, but this was the deal that was negotiated. Mark was handing over the business to me to run immediately prior to that agreement being signed. Because you can't wait. The fire is, you know, you don't wait 2 months to go send in the fire department. We were the immediate fire department, which is why it says that contract is 100% binding. And under no scenario whatsoever was Tobain ever allowed out of that agreement. The only party that had an ability to unravel that binding agreement was me, under only one scenario. And that is if Sunlot was implicated in criminal action or civil actions as a result of our involvement. Meaning I was going in as the fire department to try and clean up this mess. And if all of a sudden I'm dealing with criminal problems for trying to be the Good Samaritan, or if all of a sudden I'm getting sued and, you know, added as a party to all the class action lawsuits, all right, I have at that point, I'm the only party that has the right to walk away. You have to go read that agreement again.
Okay, I mean, I will, but it says there's a letter of intent. Look, I'm not a lawyer. It talks about being a letter of intent. Yes, it mentions it's binding, but it talks about a 45-day closure period. And from...
Yeah, so then do you see the rescission agreement from Mark?
Is that the thing he sent back to you?
Yeah, the confirmation letter that confirmed the deal. It's called the confirmation letter. It says confirmation at the top.
Yeah, but did you not... You didn't sign that.
Of course not. Mark called me up after I've retained everybody And now we're spending money, and my team has basically taken over the cleanup. The fire department is there in full force, helicopters in the air. And he said, Brock, will you please sign this rescission agreement? And then we'll sign another agreement in a week. I'm like, are you kidding? Mm-hmm. We just signed a binding agreement. We're working 24 hours basically a day. We're barely sleeping. I said, why would I sign a rescission agreement? And then what happened is Mark wanted out of the deal. And Mark didn't act in good faith. Mark refused to work on the long-form agreement. Mark did not want to do the deal at that point, even though he signed a binding agreement that required by law that he in good faith works on that agreement over the next 45 days, which he refused to do.
I mean, I've bought and sold businesses, Brock, and the types of contracts I've signed...
I've done about $5 billion worth of deals.
Yeah, way more than me and probably way more in value. But the ones...
I've spent over $25 million on lawyers.
Yeah, that's more money I've spent in my whole life. But at the same time, probably even more relevant because of the size of the businesses I've bought and sold are so small. Yet the kind of contracts I've had are very different from that agreement. They're very long. They are full of terms.
Yeah, have you ever bought a company that was, you know, underwater by $500 million that had become one of the biggest scandals in the world, major news? If you go take a look at deals like these that have been done, when you watch basically when a nuclear bomb goes off, deals are typically done in 24 hours and they're done with binding letters of intent. That's kind of what is standard. Go try and go look at some case precedents. Go look at situations like this and you'll see this is standard.
But, you know, I'm not a lawyer, so I'll need to check that. But either way, a moment ago, you said it doesn't matter who owns the business. But now it seems...
And I still stand by that statement. You're the one asking questions, so I'm answering.
But now it seems like you're getting very passionate about how binding this agreement is. So it's kind of like...
I'm pissed off. I'm pissed off that Mark let us come in here, do all this work, spend all this money, clean up his mess. And then, you know, and then he acted in bad faith, in breach of contract at the time. And is acting like, what, there's no claim here? It's like he's got a memory that operates off of convenience. I mean, it's I don't care, but I have good reason. I blew probably $1 million trying to clean up his mess.
Oh, right. And did you keep like audits of that and receipts of all that?
Of course. It's a company that raised capital with top tier investors in the ecosystem that got behind the idea of trying to clean this up.
Next up, I talked to Brock Moore about Gox Rising, but before that, I have a message from my show sponsors. So, let's talk about my new sponsor, Kraken. I've been talking about them all week. I'm super proud to have them. It's utterly amazing. It's really positive for the podcast. It gives me a lot of breathing room to work on the podcast, to develop new ideas. So, that's really cool. And also, I want to talk about why working with Kraken was so important to me. Look, the reality of running a podcast is that this is a full-time job for me now. I probably spend 60 to 70 hours a week on it. And without advertisers, I can't do it. I would have to get a job, right? So you might think I would just work with anyone and why would I have any loyalty to an exchange? But the thing is, in this kind of crazy crypto world that's flooded with bad actors, values are really important. And I've got a huge amount of respect to Jesse. And if you don't know the backstory, it's kind of funny. I have an option for my patrons at $100 a month where they can have their logo on my website and in my emails. And in comes this new patron called Jesse Powell. And I end up messaging him saying, hey, Jesse, how you doing? What company do you work for? And can you send me your logo? And he was like, oh, I'm Jesse from Kraken, but don't worry about it. I don't need my logo on your website. And I was like, oh, you're Jesse from Kraken. And I was like, okay, sorry, slightly embarrassing. Yeah, he didn't want the logo on the website. He just wanted to support the podcast. And I think that's one of the really cool things about Jesse. He's just one of the good guys. Like everything he does, from donating to Coin Center to the way he stood up to Ben Lorsky with the Bit license, and a bunch of the work he's done actually with Mt. Gox trying to help the trustee. So hopefully this gushing doesn't embarrass Jesse too much. I just want to say, look, I'm a huge fan of them. There's a lot of exchanges out there who've got kind of questionable ethics or practices, and Kraken were the only one I wanted to work with. So I'm really grateful for Jesse when I reached out to him and asked him to be a sponsor that he was cool with doing it. And also, look, if you haven't checked out my interview with Jesse, I think it's episode 48. It's worth having a listen to because he talks about building a culture of crypto values at Kraken. So I'm really glad to put my full weight behind Kraken. I hope you understand why. I hope the values mean something to you and maybe some of you will start heading back to Kraken and helping them with their mission. And if you do want to check them out, just head over to Kraken.com, which is K-R-A-K-E-N. BlockFi.com. So let's talk about my other lead sponsor, BlockFi, and I've been using this week to talk about some of the most important things about them and why I'm a big fan. And today I want to talk about how great they've been to work with, because I think you can tell a lot about a company by how the people operate within it. And they've been such a huge support for the podcast. They haven't just sent me a check each month and let the ads go. They've given me a lot of freedom on developing the ads how I want, telling the story from my perspective on what I've learned about the company and what I like about them. But they've also been really supportive to what I do. You know, Zach has always said, look, if you need anything, reach out to me. And I've used that. I have. I've asked for help with certain things. He's got back to me. And when I interviewed him in New York, I'd just flown in from Washington and he went around to the shop and bought me some beers. So he's a bit of a legend in my eyes. So I really believe in the company. I believe in the team, and I'll be a longtime supporter even after BlockFi ends their ad deal, which I'm assuming they will at some point. So definitely check them out. If you are interested in a crypto-backed loan, these are the people to go to. And if you sign up at BlockFi.com/whatbitcoindid, you can get $25 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans under $10,000, or $50 in free crypto added to customer collateral loans over $10,000, and applying takes less than 2 minutes. So you know what you need to do. It's BlockFi.com, which is BlockFi.com/whatbitcoindid. So what I'm not clear on then is, do you want to take control of Mt. Gox?
I want the bet. There's two parts of this. One is I want the creditors to get everything, and I want to make sure Mark Karpeles gets nothing.
Well, and I think, do you know what? I've read through his AMA and I've spoken to quite a few creditors. I don't believe Mark wants anything of that money.
It's not his say. The Tobin bankruptcy trustee is in charge of that.
Well, so you don't have to do anything, therefore, then, to deal with your second point. So your first point is you want to make sure the creditors get everything. Great.
Yeah, and I want to make sure Tobin gets nothing.
But you've already said Mark doesn't have control of that anyway, so that's fine.
Well, my point is, this is not an issue between Mark and I. This is an issue between the bankruptcy trustee of Tobin and I.
Okay, so do you therefore want control of the company?
What company? You have to be very specific about what.
Mt. Gox. Will you make a claim for ownership of Mt. Gox? Will you pursue legal action?
No. The claim that I think we published on our website is we're interested in putting a bid in for the brand and domain names.
Right.
Obviously, what the company is in, theoretically, it could be done through civil rehabilitation. We filed, and if you go take a look at our 33-page civil rehabilitation plan filed in April of 2014, I don't know if you've read that document.
Yeah, I have, but there is already a civil rehabilitation plan in place.
I'm talking about 2014.
Yes, but there is already a
civil. So in 2014, we wrote a civil rehabilitation plan, which is essentially more or less what's there today. You know, we wrote the plan, we filed it with the bankruptcy courts, we've done all the things. So there's two ways that we could do this today. One is we could file a civil rehabilitation plan to try and rehabilitate the original company. I don't think that makes any sense, because that would likely create delays. We're not interested in delaying the process in any way whatsoever. We want to see creditors get paid the cash and coin, all of it, without selling any more coin as soon as possible. And so far, that looks like that might happen pretty well on its own. So as of today, there's no reason for us to submit a civil rehabilitation plan. In an ideal world, based upon everything we know today, all we need to do is submit a bid to buy the intangible asset.
Okay, so there isn't going to be any legal action. Are you basically formally confirming that you're not going to be making any legal claim for the ownership of Mt. Gox?
I'm not formally saying anything, certainly not on a conversation like this. I would never.
Okay, so there is a non-zero chance that you still are interested in making a claim for Mt. Gox.
Again, this is a very non-legal question, and you're asking. You have to say, what is Mt. Gox? If we're going to talk, ask legal questions, you need to frame them appropriately.
Well, I guess what it is.
What is Mt. Gox? You mean Mt. Gox, the Japanese entity that's currently in bankruptcy?
Well, I guess what I'm getting at. So I've been on the Gox Rising website, right? And I've seen the plan and I've looked at the vision, and it says you need support of at least 12,000 creditors. So basically more than 50% for your plan.
No, that's, again, the plan that's there, if you read the bottom of it, I'm not sure you read everything from top to bottom. It doesn't sound like it, because it doesn't sound like you've actually read the letter of intent.
Yeah, I have. I have read it. I've read it all.
You have read it. Okay. It says at the bottom of those statements that we're working with creditors and those things will continue to be refined. We published something so that we can have a conversation and we talk to creditors every day.
Okay, help me understand, because I'm trying to picture it. If there is already a civil rehabilitation process in play, the trustee is already working.
Who's your Japanese lawyers? Who are you working with?
I'm not working with any lawyers, Brock.
So where are you getting your information from?
Well, I'm getting my information from what I've read online. I spoke to Daniel Kelman, who is working with the creditors. I've also obviously checked out the Telegram group. It seems to me that there is...
What Telegram group?
The creditors group.
Which one's that? There's a lot of them.
I was in a creditors one that I was recommended to go in. There is a process in place with the trustees. There is an agreement in place that X amount will be paid back, right? It was based on the dollar value at the time. And then there is a civil rehabilitation process in place.
No, that was called a liquidation, not a civil rehabilitation.
Apologies, sorry. Mark wants to put a civil rehabilitation process in place following...
Mark who?
Mark Cobalitz. Okay, what am I missing? I'm going around in circles with you here, Brock. What am I missing? What have I got wrong here? What am I not understanding? Because it sounds to me like there was a process in play and now you're part of it. Help me understand then, because I'm obviously confused between what was already happening and now what you're doing. So help me understand.
So, well, first of all, what's going on right now? Please help me understand what you consider to be the current or present circumstances. You know, I just heard you say that Mark is running this process.
No, I didn't say Mark is running it. What I'm saying, so when I spoke to Daniel Kelman, he explained
to me. Was Daniel Kelman running this process?
No, but he represents a bunch of the creditors, right?
How many?
I don't know. He didn't give me a number at the time.
Okay.
But like, you're now interviewing me and I'm the guy trying to find the facts. Let's do it the other way, because I don't know all the facts. This is why I'm speaking to everybody, you and everyone else. You tell me what is going on. What am I missing? Because from what I've seen, there is a process in place being run by the trustee. Okay, that process whereby they've agreed of the liquidated assets. Okay, and after the liquidation of the assets, there is this somewhat 160,000 bitcoins left. And from that, there's going to be a civil rehabilitation process, which will redistribute those to the creditors, right? Am I right there?
Kind of. That's all a potentiality. There is no certainties here. The bankruptcy was filed on February 28th, 2014. So we're about to hit the 5-year anniversary. And this is far more complicated and not so easy to simplify.
Tell me about it. I've been down this rabbit hole for a long time and you go around in circles. But anyway, as I understand it, and as I've said, correct me if I'm wrong, the liquidation process based on Japanese law was designed to pay back people the value in yen. Because of the ridiculous rise in the price of Bitcoin, there's like 160,000 Bitcoin left over. Mark said, his claim is he doesn't want these. Okay. Jed has said.
Is it Mark saying that? Tobain has to make that statement.
Of course. But he's.
And Tobain is in bankruptcy. So it gets even more complicated. This is my point. It's so complicated.
Okay. Just bear with me. Who owns Tobain? Mark's 100% shareholder, right?
Yes, correct.
Okay. So there was...
And by the way, Mark is personally in bankruptcy too.
Okay. But there was conjecture that because of the way Japanese law works, usually you don't have a bankruptcy followed by a massive increase in the value of the assets of a company. It's unheard of.
Yeah, no, these things only happen like Beverly Hillbillies when, you know, all of a sudden a failed business has an investment or has some other asset that then, you know, skyrockets in value. It's like you struck oil where all of a sudden a company that is... substantially underwater in terms of its liabilities vastly, you know, exceed its assets, to then all of a sudden somehow the assets exceed the liabilities. This is very rare. This entire case is really interesting because of how unusual it is on so many levels. And then on top of it all, it's not in the United States. It's in Japan, where bankruptcy almost never happens in Japan. Bankruptcies are very rare in Japan too.
But let's stay on track, Brock. So as I understand it, you say it's different, but the conjecture was, or the theory was, that Tobain would have a claim to those assets because of the way Japanese bankruptcy law works. Mark...
And they currently have a claim filed today.
Okay, but Mark has said...
They're making a claim.
Okay, well, Mark has said, and I think to numerous people, that he has no interest in that money. He's run his AMA. Let's just trust him for now.
I want to point out one fact because that's inaccurate.
Okay.
In terms of the biggest claim on the Mt. Gox estate is from CoinLab. The second largest claim is from Tobain. Tobain has a claim right now for essentially all of the Bitcoin that's currently outstanding. more than half of all of the Bitcoin. Okay. So Mark Karpeles currently has a claim, currently,
okay,
that is currently there for, I think, about half or more of all of the Bitcoin that is currently held by the estate. So he may be saying this, but the facts are that he's asking for more than half of all of the Bitcoin. That's currently a claim that is in place and levied in the courts. So it's just simply not true.
Okay, well, I'm with him tomorrow. I'll ask him that question, of course. But bear with me.
But, by the way, I'll send you a copy of that claim. It's public record.
Great.
If you go to the court.
I'll read that, but hopefully it's not in Japanese. But anyway.
It is in Japanese, but we can get it translated for you.
Okay. But anyway, let's just stick with the fact that Mark has made a public declaration he has no interest in these Bitcoins. He wants them redistributed to the creditors through a civil rehabilitation. And I spoke to Daniel Kelman, and he seems happy with that process. So what I'm trying to understand is, if that is the case, and just say we trust it, what is it that you are offering or trying to do that's different from that?
Well, I'm interested in buying the intangible assets, and I, for one, wouldn't trust Mark Karpeles at all. I mean, are you saying, would you trust Mark Karpeles with your money?
I don't think I'd trust either of you with my money.
That's fine. But are you saying you would trust Mark Karpeles? I mean, you just told me, let's trust him.
I'm just saying, for the sake of trying to move this conversation forward, Brock.
Okay. I for one, Mark Karpeles has a claim. Currently, the second largest claim after CoinLab is currently in the courts on behalf of Mark Karpeles. So he's got this claim outstanding for hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
Trust me, I'm not interested in anything. It's the facts are the facts. Let's not discount the facts. There's a claim in the bankruptcy courts today on behalf of Mark Karpeles' company that he is the sole shareholder of, asking for hundreds of millions of dollars. Facts.
You know what though, Brock? Take this in the right way. And let me explain it. I would trust Mark in this situation to do the right thing over you. But let me explain myself, because you're probably thinking, why are you saying that? He's already messed up the exchange. I 100% believe that Mark does not want that money, and he just wants the funds redistributed to the creditors. I still don't know what you're doing, right? And I'm trying to get to the bottom of this, so perhaps you can help me.
I've said it a half a dozen times. I'm interested in putting in a bid for the brand and the domains, the intangible assets. That's it. Let me repeat it a couple more times so that you understand.
Okay.
I know this is a little complicated. I'm interested in putting in a bid to buy the intangible assets, specifically the brand and the domain name.
So explain to me.
And that's currently all.
Okay.
There is nothing more.
Okay. It just doesn't feel like that. It feels like you are interested in the...
So what? Tell me what I've done. Mark Karpeles has a claim in the courts. What filings have I made? What have I done that's different than this?
Well, so I'm on your website, right?
What fact are you basing this upon? I know you have a lot of opinions.
Oh, no, I don't have a...
That Mark is trustworthy, that Mark has only good intentions. I get that you made these statements. And that Mark doesn't want anything, even though he's got a claim for hundreds of millions of dollars outstanding with the courts and has for years. I get all that. So please tell me what you base that upon.
So what it is like, I'm still trying to figure out what it is you're doing. If you're only interested in the brand of the domain, why all these public statements? Why this website? Why all these interviews? Why aren't you just making a bid for the domain and the brand, waiting for civil rehabilitation to finish, and then executing your plan? What's this whole kind of media circus about and these arguments? I don't understand.
Well, the media circus is created by guys like you.
Not sure. I'm just asking questions.
Hold on. How am I creating the circus?
Well, so you're doing lots of press, lots of interviews. You're doing lots of...
I haven't even hired a single PR person. I gave a talk about this at the Miami Bitcoin conference. And I was asked to give a talk at the Japanese conference. I've given two conversations. I don't have a single marketing person or PR person contacting media, nobody. By having two conversations saying, hey, here is what is going on with Mt. Gox and what creditors should be aware of, and giving people an update on what's going on with Mt. Gox. And I've been involved for 5, 6, 7 years. That's a fact. I did sign deals with Mark Karpeles. That's a fact. I am aware of what's going on with this. This is a fact. And because I gave a conversation about Mt. Gox and I said, hey, I think it'd be a good idea to resuscitate or revive the exchange, and a bunch of people have been interested in having a conversation with me about that.
Okay.
And they're all interested in who owns Mt. Gox. That's not even the conversation I think is interesting. But guys like you make that the conversation. And Mark Karpeles makes it the conversation. I'm interested in relaunching the Mt. Gox exchange. It might be a good or a bad idea. I think it's a good idea. And that should be the only conversation people are having, because that's all that really matters. That's the only thing I'm focused on.
Okay, but I'm on the Gox Rising website, right? I'm literally just reading what's on there. It's, what is Gox Rising? It's a movement related to the bankruptcy process, and the goals are to keep creditors informed. Great. Support creditors being paid out as quickly as possible. So how does Gox Rising support creditors being paid out as quickly as possible?
I mean, we're just having these conversations. You know how many creditors I'm talking to that don't even know what's going on? And so here's a good question for you. Is there, what website do you go to? And where in a matter of, call it 15 minutes, you know, you can find out what's happening with this case and what's going on with Mt. Gox. Where do you go to figure that out?
Well, I start with Google.
And so you go to Google, what do you find?
I find a variety of things. Find articles,
and
news.
What you're going to likely find is that from one article to the next, there's, you know, incredible inconsistencies.
Yep.
No one seems to really know what's going on. And ultimately what you're going to find out is that you have to go into Reddit and you have to go into Telegram groups and you have to spend hours and hours and hours researching. And by the time you've done all of that, you still probably are as confused as you started, you know, a little bit more.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's a fact.
But I'm talking to you and I'm still confused because I can't seem to get an answer from you. Like,
and by the way, I'm confused.
Okay.
You and me both.
Let's try again though, Brock. Let's try again. Okay, so your website says, and it's your website, so it says support creditors being paid out as quickly as possible. How does Gox Rising support creditors being paid out as quickly as possible?
These are intentions. We would like to see creditors paid out.
But how do you do it?
All of the tension point. And as quickly as possible. How are we doing that? We're talking to lots of creditors. We're talking about what's going on here at Mt. Gox. We have Japanese counsel. You know, we're doing what little we can. I don't know if we're going to end up doing much of anything. You know, this is what we want. These are our goals. These are objectives. You know, will we end up being responsible for anything? I don't know. How are you helping creditors? How is, you know, Mark Karpeles helping creditors? You know, what is Mark doing?
Yeah, I know. I trust me. You'll hear my interview with Mark. I'll ask him very similar questions, but it's just, I'm just going by the language on your website, support creditors being paid out. I'm wondering how you do that. Let's go on to the next point. It says maximize distribution to creditors. How does Gox Rising maximize the distribution to creditors?
Again, these are goals. We want to see creditors get everything. We also are proposing two things that are not currently discussed. One is by buying the intangible assets and relaunching the exchange and giving creditors ownership in that new exchange. That gets them more than they would get under the current CR plan, period.
Yeah, the 16.5%.
And that was when we settled. There were two class action lawsuits filed against Mt. Gox in 2014 in the United States on behalf of the 103,000 account holders. We went in and dealt with the class action lawsuits and settled the class action lawsuits.
Okay.
In exchange for 16.5%, which is where that number comes from. The class action lawsuits negotiated on behalf of creditors in 2014.
Okay. Can you even appreciate from my side? Because the website feels more like it's like a campaign site. You know, it's a movement, however you want to put it. But it says here, Gox Rising will present a detailed civil rehabilitation plan to the Japanese trustee by the 22nd of April 2019. Okay. So there is already a civil rehabilitation plan. Is this an alternative civil rehabilitation plan?
As of right now, we have no intentions of filing a civil rehabilitation plan. As of right now, we are happy with what the bankruptcy trustee is doing as of today.
See, can you see from my side, though? Like, you obviously made the claim earlier, you don't think I read things, but this is on your website. I'm using this for my research, and it says you are.
Yeah.
So does that need updating?
And so we are. Again, we're dealing with the bank. We're dealing with the bankruptcy courts and Japanese counsel and creditors on a daily basis.
So the website's out of date.
Figuring this out as we go. We are interested, again, simply put, in putting in a bid for the intangible assets and helping in any other way we think we can. And if there's nothing for us to do, there's nothing we're going to do. We are clearly not going to do anything that slows down the process or harms creditors.
Right.
Period.
Great. Okay. So there's no new civil rehabilitation plan, because obviously you can see where I've why I've come to ask these questions, because that's what I've read. If it's not relevant anymore, I think you can at least see that
the site's being updated.
Well, but then I think you can at least see that I have done my research. So let's move on to that.
I'm glad that you followed some of this stuff. It sounds like you're not aware of Mark Karpeles' claim. He was the biggest claim on the Mt. Gox estate until CoinLab updated their
suit. Hey, listen, look, you weren't aware of something that was like still on your website. Look, there's so much here to digest. I think we can all give each other a break, not knowing everything.
Yeah, but you're being very unfair.
Oh, okay. Apologies. Tell me how I'm being unfair, Brock.
No, it's all good though. I'm almost out of time anyway. I've got 6 minutes. I've got to wrap up. So let's make sure we get through whatever else that you want. I want to make sure that I'm giving you all the time.
Of course. Okay. So last couple of things. So obviously there's no civil rehabilitation plan. So really you just want to launch an exchange, right? So
that's pretty much, if you listen to anything I've said, that's kind of what I've been saying.
Cool.
The whole time. And I've been saying that since 2014.
So all you want is the domain name and the brand. That's all you want.
I've been saying this since 2014.
Okay.
I've been saying this longer than anyone.
So if you couldn't get hold of the domain name and brand, couldn't you just do this with another domain name and brand?
Do what?
Just create another exchange.
I'm not interested in creating another exchange. I'm already involved in many. I've already, you know, I've invested millions of dollars in Coinbase and investor in Kraken and this and that. I'm in tons of exchanges. I co-founded BitThumb and launched the Korean markets. I'm in lots of exchanges. I've done this many times. I've been running digital currency exchanges, I think, longer than anyone on the planet.
Okay. But it has to, so it's really the importance of the brand, because you think with that brand, you can create quite a significant exchange.
Well, I'm interested in changing the narrative. Mt. Gox is a bad word. Mt. Gox is the term or word that's used by people when they want to criticize people in crypto. They're like, oh yeah, but what about Mt. Gox? I want to take our industry's greatest weakness and turn it into a strength.
Okay. All right. Fair.
It's a crazy idea. And the odds of it being successful are, you know, who knows? But I spend a lot of my time doing philanthropic work. I do a lot of altruistic things. And this is one of those crazy ideas that I've decided to pursue. Will it work? I don't know. I chose to do this when Mt. Gox failed the first night. And I have a bad habit of trying to finish what I start.
Okay, that's fair enough. Okay, so I guess you've got a couple of minutes left. So last couple of questions. And thank you again. I do appreciate your time. So what are the next steps for you now with this whole process? Apart from, if you want to buy the name and the brand, obviously, you can do that. That's not a difficult thing. You just make an application to buy. What else is going to be going on? What else should we keep an eye on?
Well, continuing to try and keep people informed. Right now, there is not any good source of information that's out there, as I assume you can agree with. There's no website where I can go see, if I'm a creditor, what's going on? What are the deadlines, what are the timetables? What's going on? What are the information? Who are all the claims? There is not one good source of information that I've been able to find. The only thorough source of information I've been able to find is Reddit.
Actually, Andy Pag has a good website. Have you seen his?
Yeah, wait. Andy's wonderful. I really like Andy.
He's got a good website.
I think Andy's a quality guy.
Have you been to his website?
Yeah, and I've also been to, I'm in his Telegram groups. I had a call with him, you know, in the last few days.
Okay, well, his is pretty good.
Andy's doing a great job. He's one of those guys that I'm a big fan of his.
Yeah. Okay, I guess last thing, and please take this question in the right way. None of this is meant to be like spiky or wind you up. If you listen to any of my other interviews, I'm fair with everyone. But like, should people trust you? Like, are you a trustworthy guy in this whole process? Because you said the things about Mark.
I believe everyone should make decisions for themselves. You know, trust yourself, trust your gut, do what you want.
Because I'm not sure. Like, I still...
If you don't trust me, I mean, that's your prerogative. You know, I'm not asking you to trust me.
No, it doesn't come down to me. I mean, I'm thinking about other people because, like, how do I explain this? You've got really fired up during this interview, like really fired up.
Yeah, because I care about what happens here. I care. I've invested a lot of time and a lot of money, you know, in this. And my only motivation in the beginning to do this was altruistic. It's like, oh my God, this is the worst thing that's ever happened to Bitcoin. What are we going to do?
Okay, so what?
Yeah, I care about Bitcoin. I've devoted my life, the last 7 years of my life, pretty much exclusively to this industry. And yes, I care. I care a great deal about what happens to Bitcoin. I care a great deal about what happens here. I care a great deal about humanity.
Right.
I care. I really care.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, fine. But I still can't. I don't know, Brock. It's a tough one. It's a tough one because I feel like I've heard all this stuff against Mark and all this impassioned kind of arguments, but I still don't know your intentions here. Like,
wow. Let me repeat it a last time for you. My intentions are to put in a bid for the intangible assets, specifically the branded domain, and to give creditors that sign up for it, that want a piece of it. No one's forcing anyone to take anything they don't want. A piece of that action, as I committed to when I settled two class action lawsuits in 2014. And I'm continuing to follow through on the exact same thing that I started 5 years ago.
But you still can't make any commitment to saying you've got no interest in the claim to the...
I have a strong interest that Mark Karpeles gets nothing. And I'm going to do whatever I can to make sure Mark gets nothing and that the creditors get everything.
Do you know what's the weird thing is that it's a very strange thing because I've spoken to a lot of people around this and almost entirely everyone I've spoken to is like, you know, Mark's all right. Everyone seems to think, you know what, you know, time's passed, time's a healer, Mark's all right, and he's kind of coming out this okay, and yet you've kind of somehow coming out of this a bit of a bad guy. Like, how do you make sense of that?
I'm really curious who you're talking to.
Well, I've spoken...
I talk to lots of people, and I do not keep hearing that Mark is okay.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people that are very, very, very upset about what happened at Mt. Gox, and most of those people blame Mark for what happened. I don't know who your data set is coming from, but that's a really unusual set of responses.
I think, you know, the variety of people I've spoken to, and I must have done...
Daniel Kelman? Yes, Daniel Kelman thinks Mark's okay.
Oh, no.
Kim Nelson thinks Mark's okay.
No, not just those people. Like, I've spoken to at least 20 different people in preparation. Also, if you go through the Reddit AMA, like, you know, most people who are admitting they've had losses, they're kind of okay with it. There isn't really a lot of anger towards him through that AMA. And I'm just saying, it's like, and then, you know, you've obviously had a lot of, you've taken some stick with this process, right? You must recognize that.
What stick?
Well, people are saying you're trying to make claim for the company. People don't understand what your plan is. You've offered to go and try and recover the rest of the funds. And people are like, well, what are the plans to rescue the rest of the funds? Go and discover them. You've talked about doing an ICO. Like, there's all these different things. And people are just not a fan.
Hold on. Where did I talk about doing an ICO? I don't recall ever having said that once anywhere.
Right. I'd have to go back to my notes. But I read there was... Here, give me 1 second. Gox coin.
Yeah, I've talked about the prospects of tokenizing future recoveries. There's no plan to do anything. Actually, I think what I've told everybody, and I think even in the documents published, is that we are encouraging creditors to form a foundation that is governed by creditors and that we might fund that, and that creditors should go continue to pursue further recovery efforts. And one of the things that they could do is tokenize it. I have zero plans in doing that. I obviously have been very involved in creating a number of tokens going all the way back to MasterCoin. And I think that creditors should consider that. I think it's an interesting idea and it's one that I would help them with, but I have zero plans. And I think I can say there's probably a 0% chance that I would ever do an ICO. There might be a security token one day if we're lucky on the exchange to create liquidity for creditors and things of that nature. But, you know, again, I have no idea.
All right. Well, listen, look, you've gone over your time and I appreciate that. So just moving forward, like, what message would you like to leave people? Like, who do you want to hear from? How should people get in touch with the things you're doing? What are your final comments?
Well, you can go to goxrising.com. You can find me on Twitter. You can jump in Telegram groups. You know, we're interested in hearing what you think. We're, you know, talking to everyone we can, making sure that, you know, we are not a hindrance in this process. And, you know, grateful to all of the people that have signed up. There's lots of people that have signed up and actually think that what we're talking about doing here is a very good idea. And thank you to, you know, those hundreds of creditors that have done so already.
Well, listen, I appreciate your time and I will ask Mark, on Saturday when I see him, what you told me. So I will do that. But look, I appreciate your time and good luck to you. I'm sure we'll chat again in the future sometime.
All right, take care.
Okay, so what did you make of that? What did you make of Brock? What do you think of what he had to say? What do you think of his involvement in Mt. Gox and Mt. Gox Rising? As I said in the intro, I really look forward to your feedback. I thought this one went weird. I didn't think it was a great interview, but like I said, I'm not sure if that was down to me or Brock or both of us. I just found it really difficult. I found it really hard to get to what his incentives are. I know he kept saying during the interview he just wanted to buy the assets and the brand and the domain, and that he wanted to change the narrative and stop Mark Karpeles getting any money. But from everything else I've read and seen, it wasn't just about that. There has been the talk of this ICO. There has been this talk about him owning the assets. And I can't help but feel that as the weight of opinions come against him, there's been like this changing narrative and this effort to backtrack. Prepping for this was also hard because the series came together at short notice and I had to move the interview with Brock forward a day because I was suddenly flying out to Japan to interview Mark. So I wasn't as prepared as I'd like to be. And also, look, this might sound really unprofessional, but I just thought Brock was a bit of a dick during the interview. I thought he was really patronizing, like he accused me of not reading everything, yet he wasn't aware that his website, Gox Rising, was stating that they were going to issue their own CR plan. So I don't know, it's really annoyed me, this interview. I'm really sorry if that's unprofessional, I apologize. And also, there was all this hate towards Mark, but when he visited Mark in Japan, he talked about helping his profile. So yeah, I find getting to his incentives and trusting him really difficult. He seems to tell people what they want to hear and then turn on them when he doesn't get what he wants. And then starts throwing out all this stuff about, oh, I've invested in loads of companies and I want to help Bitcoin. Sorry, I just don't buy it. I think he's been more of a hindrance than a help. I didn't enjoy doing the interview. Yeah, I just want to move on for it. So anyway, I'll put it out there. It is what it is. Let me know what you think. You can email me on hello@whatbitcoindid.com and I definitely look forward to the feedback on this one. And I just want to say a big thank you to everyone who supports the show. I usually do a bit here where I tell you all the different things you can do, but I've talked enough today. If you want to support the show, it's really easy. Just head over to my website, whatbitcoindid.com. Click on the support section. It'll tell you everything you can do, whether you want to leave a tip, whether you just want to leave a review, whether you want to become a patron, whatever you want to do. There's a whole bunch of stuff there. And yeah, so God, I'm absolutely shattered. This week has been absolutely killer. Doing a show a day has been absolutely insane. I've got the final interview coming out tomorrow. It's with BBC journalist Andy Pagg, who also heads up one of the creditor groups, Mt. Gox Legal. We kind of do a reflection on it all and kind of share some kind of ideas about kind of what I've learned and found and, you know, what his opinions are. So yeah, definitely check that out. That's the final one tomorrow. I'm going to take the rest of the weekend off. I need a break and we'll be back to like normal show schedule next week. Like I always say, if you've got any questions and you want to reach out to me, my email address is hello@whatbitcoindid.com.